Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. This is the Monday morning edition of The Cross in the Desert, and it is a pleasure and a joy to be with you this morning. Well, we have quite the challenge and the task ahead of us today. I'm going to do my very best on this program today to cut through the hype, to cut through the hysteria, and get down to the facts about President Trump's recent executive order banning immigration to several countries. We're going to talk about this issue. I mean, literally, last night I was at work, and it's the weekend at work. It's much more laid back. And like everyone else, because when I'm at work, I see people texting on the phone. We shouldn't be doing that. That's our job there, right? Well, I mean to tell you, all I did was post my opinion about this. And you would not believe that the floodgates of liberal rhetoric just came gushing out. And so I spent so much time last night fighting and debating this subject with liberals who have been poisoned. Journalistic institutions have been poisoned with the rhetoric, the misrepresentations, the half-truths about what President Trump has done. He promised he was going to do this for the safety of our nation, and he did just exactly what he promised. So what I thought I would do this morning, first thing up I'm going to read President Trump's statement regarding the recent executive order concerning extreme vetting. I want you to hear from him. Quote, "America is a proud nation of immigrants, and we will continue to show compassion for those fleeing oppression, but we will do so while protecting our own citizens and border. It has always been the land of the free and the home of the brave. We will keep it free and keep it safe, as the media knows but refuses to say. My policy is similar to what President Obama did in 2011. By the way, listen to this, when he banned visas for refugees from Iraq for 6 months. The seven countries named in the executive order are the same countries previously identified by the Obama administration as, quote, sources of terror. To be clear, this is not a Muslim ban, as the media is falsely reporting. This is not about religion. This is about terror and keeping our country safe. There are over 40 different countries worldwide that are majority Muslim that are not affected by this order. We will again be issuing visas to all countries once we are sure we have reviewed and implemented the most secure policies over the next 90 days. I have tremendous feeling for the people involved in this horrific humanitarian crisis in Syria. My first priority will always be to protect and serve our country. But as president, I will find ways to help all those who are suffering. I want you to notice a couple of things from the very get-go. Notice that this ban against refugees was implemented by President Obama back in 2011 about Iraq refugees for 6 months. Now, wait a minute. You would think that what Donald Trump did on Friday was the most unforgivable sin, but once again, the media glosses over that this happened a half years ago by President Obama. I doubt very seriously that he suffered any grief compared to what Donald Trump has suffered. And notice what else President Trump says. This is not a Muslim ban. I want to help you with this. I want to go to the Daily Caller, and I want you to hear from Peter Hassan. He's a reporter, associate editor. Peter writes, the majority of the world's Muslims are not affected by President Donald Trump's executive order Friday, barring citizens of Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen from the United States. While all seven countries targeted by the ban are predominantly Muslim, they contain just a small fraction of the world's Muslims, who make up majority populations of 42 other countries. What countries have the majority population of Muslims? Indonesia, India, Pakistan. They account for a third of the world's Muslim population. None of the three are included in this visa ban. In fact, only one of the countries affected by the ban, Iran, has more than 2% of the global Muslim population. And in Iran, where death to American Israel chants are common, they contain just 4.6% of the world's Muslims. So I hear this all the time. It's a Muslim ban. You're banning my family. It's anti-Muslim. You're being bigoted. You're being discriminatory. No. This is about banning jihadist terrorists. If we remember the things we've been told by our intelligence, ISIS has promised to sneak in terrorists through the refugee population. And so President Trump, who took an oath to protect his country and defend the Constitution, is doing exactly what the president should be doing if he had not issued this ban. And a wave of refugees had been admitted in to become potential terrorists, we would hear the hue and cry about Donald Trump's sin of not protecting us. So in a way, this is kind of the old cliche of damned if you do and damned if you don't. And so my whole point in bringing this up is that Donald Trump, what he is doing exactly what he said he was going to do. And this is very important, that we have this whole situation understood from the very get-go. Now, those are some of the facts. Donald Trump is not a racist. He is not a dictator. I tell you, the rhetoric and the spoo that goes out over the internet from fake news, and that's what they are. They're absolutely fake news. They have done everything from the very get-go to delegitimize our president. And yet, what he did on Friday, let me explain something to you. As you know, I have a heart for refugees. I have a heart for Iranian refugees in particular. Some of my Iranian friends are very upset about this. My answer is very clear. Number one, in the clause for the executive order, there is a specific clause for those people in those countries that I mentioned, if they are fleeing religious persecution, if their lives are in danger, then they will receive top priority to be granted asylum. And so, as Donald Trump pointed out, he cares, number one, for Christian refugees and as well as those refugees suffering religious persecution. So in the case of those that are suffering in that state, they will be given top priority either during the ban if their life's in danger, or top priority once the ban is lifted, they will be on the top of the list. This is very important. So I want you to hear what Donald Trump has to say about refugees and Christian refugees in particular. This was a CBN special interview a few days ago. Let's listen.
Persecuted Christians, we've talked about this overseas. Right. The refugee program that or the refugee changes you're looking to make as it relates to persecuted Christians, do you see them as kind of a priority here? As
yes.
You do?
Yes, they've been horribly treated. Do you know, if you were a Christian in Syria, it was impossible, very, very, at least very, very tough to get into the United States. If you were a Muslim, you could come in. But if you were a Christian, it was almost impossible. And the reason that was so unfair is that everybody was persecuted, in all fairness, but they were chopping off the heads of everybody, but more so the Christians. And I thought it was very, very unfair. So we are going to help them.
This is very important. Donald Trump has done something that President Obama failed in. As you notice what he said, many of the Muslims were automatically let in, but the Christians were excluded. And that's important that he is doing what he says he's going to do. Because, again, he is taking refugees who are fleeing religious persecution, and in this case Christians, he's giving them top priority in the situation that they're in. And so I wanted to bring this up to let you know that our president has a heart of compassion for suffering refugees. The ban is a necessary evil, if you will, to get our vetting system reevaluated, revamped, and so we can do everything in our power to stop the influx of terrorists. Okay? This is very important because they are masters of disguise. If you know anything about the news, what they have done in the countries of France and Germany, they've come in through the refugee population, and as they promised, they did those terrorist attacks. So we as a country, as a nation, and yes, we're a nation of immigrants, we want to make sure that people are safe that are living here. And so it is necessary. It's not an easy thing to go through. And my heart goes out to my Iranian friends who have family members that aren't fleeing persecution, that want to come here. There is a ban temporarily, but trust me, it's temporary. And it will soon be lifted, and things will be much better, much safer. And I hope that this helped you this morning. I know that it's a very emotional topic, but what I'm trying to do is to cut through all of the rhetoric and the misrepresentation. And I think Donald Trump's statement, President Trump's statement, just that I read in the beginning of the program, puts things in perspective. Yes, I know there have been people delayed at airports, and that's unfortunate because of the way this has been implemented. Maybe it could have been implemented a little bit better. Maybe there could have been a little bit more advance notice. I'll say that, you know, and say that the implementation is a very frustrating thing in certain situations. But green card holders are not going to be excluded, that have went through the fingerprint, the vetting process. They're not going to be thrown out of the country. This is a ban to take the vetting system and reevaluate it and improve it. And I want to say that this is something that's very, very important, because the only way we're going to have a safe nation is to have a leader that loves his country, to have a leader that loves to protect his people and will do what he promised on the campaign trail. More than often, when a candidate makes promises, once he gets into office, he fails to do so. The first week of Donald Trump has been an amazing week of where he has said to the people, what I promised you, I'm going to do. And he has made good on his promises. And so what I would say to a lot of my skeptical friends is please be patient and give Donald Trump an opportunity to do what he's going to do, make America great again. Okay. What I want to share with you now is a little bit of information that you need to know from the women's rally of last weekend. First thing I want to tell you, my friend Maral and I, we got together. Maral is an Iranian woman who fled the nation of Iran about a year and a half ago. She was going to be arrested. And to make a long story short, she was provided resources to join a refugee group, and she traveled literally on foot over the mountains of Turkey. She was in a rubber raft in the Aegean Sea. She made her way, and she was very sick. It was a very grueling journey, all the way from Iran to Germany. Today, she's a citizen there. I talked to her about this women's rally, and I said, you know, all of these women are complaining and whining, and yet they have freedom here in America. Why didn't they talk about ladies like you that lived under oppression and fear in Iran? And so I wrote a script for Maral to read, a message to the women protesters in the women's rally. And it's a short little video, about a minute and 50 seconds long. And Maral did an amazing job. Now, she stumbled a little bit because she doesn't know English really well, but she did an amazing job. And let me tell you, I posted that on Facebook, made a YouTube version. Do you know that video has soared to heights beyond what any of us could ask or think? It has resonated and connected with people all over the world. I want to thank Jala, I want to thank Kindred and Annie for connecting this little video to their various groups. There are people in Australia, all over the world, that have shared her video. Do you know it was made on Tuesday, and today it has almost 17,000 views and over 400 shares? I just thank the Lord that he used this little video that I wrote a script for and Maral spoke. And Maral, you can see here, she's just being herself. But please go to my Facebook page or go up on YouTube and just share this amazing video that Maral has made it and has connected with people all over the world talking about the plight of suffering women, especially in Iran, that don't have the freedom that these women protesters have. And she does it so respectfully. She does it so kindly. And I think that's part of the reason why it's been so very, very well received. With that in mind, I want to mention to you, on my last program, I talked about one of the women organizers, Linda Sarsour. Linda Sarsour has connections with terrorist groups. She's she is a Muslim woman. She's a citizen here. But she is complaining that the states here in America, 22 states have banned Sharia law. She wants to practice her faith. What I find so absolutely contradictory is why would a women's rights group have as one of their organizers a Muslim woman, a powerful, outspoken Muslim woman, as one of its organizers? Because anyone that knows anything about Islam knows how oppressive that system is to the average woman. And so one of the organizers was a Muslim woman. Now, you know, I want to tell you something. I have to say this is what I believe. A lot of the Muslim activist groups that I think want to change our laws here and implement Sharia law, they hijack these leftist movements, these protests. They jump on board, right? But their whole point of doing so is to make inroads into the female population, right? And in this case, it was all female, to make inroads into the female population for the spreading and propaganda of Islam. That seems pretty simple, right? That's what I think Linda Sarsour is all about. So I decided I wanted to tell you really what Sharia law is all about. This is the real war on women. And one of the organizers of the women's protest rally believes very strongly in this. Under Sharia law, you just go to the Quran chapter 4, Surah chapter 4. Under Sharia law, women, wives can be beaten. Now, that's not a big deal, right? No. This is a women's rights rally, but here's a woman, one of the organizers, who believes in Sharia law that women can be beaten if their husband suspects them of adultery. Under Sharia law, females enjoy fewer rights than males. This is very clear. Marriage and sexual intercourse with prepubescent girls is permissible, according to the Quran. Under Sharia law, wives do not share the same divorce rights as their husbands. Under Sharia law, female rulers are frowned upon. And then this really comes not only from the Quran, but the Hadith, where Muhammad said, when he heard about the people of Persia had made the daughter their queen, Muhammad is reputed as saying, never will succeed such a nation as makes a woman their ruler. So according to the Hadith, this saying of the Prophet Muhammad, which Muslims like to distance themselves with and say it's not true, they view Muhammad as the great emancipator of women, but in essence, he was not that kind of person. Under Sharia law, of course, wives have to be subservient to their husbands. A husband has absolute authority over his wife. Under Sharia law, a man can forbid his wife to go out from the home, even to the mosque. And in the Hadith, Muhammad tells a woman that her prayer has no value if it is done without her husband's permission. Now, the manual states that a woman may not leave the city without her husband or a member of her unmarriageable kin. She must have someone accompany her. It is unlawful for her to travel and unlawful for her husband to allow her to travel. Under Sharia law, well, men can have more than one wife. Polygamy is allowed, Surah chapter 4, verse 3. Interesting things I found out under Sharia law, women are deemed lacking in faith and intelligence. And this is from a Hadith from Al-Bukhari, the most authoritative Sunni collection of Muhammad's sayings. Muhammad says in this Hadith that the majority of the dwellers in hellfire are women. He had a vision of hell, and he said that the majority of those in hell were women. That the reason they're there is women curse frequently. They're ungrateful to their husbands. Women are deficient in intelligence and religion. And finally, under Sharia law, raping female captives is permissible. Surah chapter 4, verse 3, 424, Surah 23, 5 through 6, 70, 22 through 30. I have this list. If you need these references, I'll be happy to give them to you. But what I'm trying to say to you is that it's important to understand what's happening in our world today. It's understanding that one of the reasons why Donald Trump initiated this ban is that he is doing unlike what President Obama really did. He's not afraid to say radical Islam. He wants to protect us from radical Islam. And right here, what's happening in the midst of all that's going on with the ban, we have a movement and a woman, one of the organizers of that woman movement, that's doing everything they can to implement Sharia law here in the United States. And it's incompatible with our Constitution. Homosexuals are periodically thrown from the rooftops under Sharia law. I see videos in Iran of those that are thieves that have stolen something and their hands are amputated under Sharia law. And so I'm giving you just the graphic examples, but that's what Sharia law amounts to. And you may say, well, there may be some radical Muslims that believe that, but they can't do that here. Take a look at the UK and take a look at the gradual way they made inroads into the government in the UK. My good friend Uzay Bulat has a great piece on this, which I don't have available right now. But she showed as the Muslim population begins to grow from percentage to percentage, they begin to implement this law, and in Great Britain, the UK, and in France, how much sway is Sharia law? They have Muslim patrols on the streets in the UK. They will go out periodically, and they will confront women, non-Muslim women, you should be wearing hijab, and they harass them. They have these kinds of things happening all the time. And you may say, well, that's the Europe situation, folks. That's only the beginning. The way that Islam wants to dominate the world through one way or another is through the refugee population. This is very clear. Now, do we stop letting in immigrants? No, we do not stop letting in immigrants. What we do is radically revamp our vetting system to the extent that people like that will not be allowed in. They will be revealed. We will unveil their plans. We will stop. Lots of people don't believe that this system will do anything. You can revamp it for 3 months, but folks, it's going to change. It's going to be revamped, and things are going to improve. We can't afford another San Bernardino. We certainly can't afford another 9/11. We can't afford another Fort Hood. We can't afford these terrorist attacks that are happening. Another Orlando. We can go down the list after list, and we can see what's going on. Chattanooga, Tennessee, a Muslim radical shooting Marines at a recruiting office. We can't afford this. Our country is at stake. And by the way, presidents down through the past have done a ban. In fact, Jimmy Carter, President Carter in 1980, banned Iranian immigrants from coming in because our people were held hostage. And so where was the hue and cry about that? Why is it that the media is selective in their remembrance of what's happening in the world? But these things have happened in our history. Across both sides of the aisle, Democrat, Republican, there has been a ban. And it's always been for the protection of our country. And so I guess what I want to say in conclusion to all of this is that I have a heart for refugees. I love refugees. I write letters for them. I write books for them. I send petitions out in their behalf. I have a real heart for them. And so it grieves me that my Iranian friends are suffering in some way because of this, as I explained. But I know that it's only temporary, and I know that it's going to change the vetting system, and I know it's going to be much more improved once it's over with by about summertime. And so I have a heart, and I care about them. And so they know my feelings. They know my whole attitude about this. And I think that they will understand that this is necessary. It's only temporary. So I hope that I've somewhat delved into answering your questions today and made the case that the security of our nation is a vow. It's an oath that our president takes. But one thing I'd like to say in conclusion about this whole matter, why is there so much outrage against President Trump? And let me answer that for you. The outrage, really, if you want to get specific, needs to be geared towards President Obama, past president, former President Obama. You see, the ban is directly put in place to stop ISIS terrorists from coming in through the refugee population. Donald Trump did not create ISIS. President Obama did, through his foreign policy failure with Iraq, pulling our troops out way too early when they should not have been, created a vacuum in Iraq, which in turn opened up the floodgates for ISIS. And so the ban is in response to the failure of President Barack Obama. The outrage for this ban, if you will, should be directed at him and not at Trump, because if he had not pulled the troops out of Iraq, there would have been no ISIS implementation. We wouldn't then need a ban today. So I'm not, you know, pointing the finger and blaming everything on President Obama, but this clearly is a foreign policy failure on his part. And because of this failure of foreign policy, it created the vacuum. And the creation of the vacuum, letting ISIS become a major entity, created the terrorist attacks. And as a result, we have to have a ban because of Barack Obama's failed Iraq policy. Very important. That's an important point because I believe all of these protests that you see, all of this outrage, is funded, it's engineered by none other than George Soros. And there's probably many more protests that have been planned and scheduled. And this will continue for the next 4 years that Donald Trump is president, very simply because they hate him. They will see no good in anything that he does, and therefore they will do everything they can to stop short of what he's doing and to give him hell, if you will, for the next 4 years. So I hope that in this last half an hour I've helped you understand a little bit better the executive order on immigration ban. And remember some of the facts that the media conveniently forgets. Just remember that 5 years ago, through Obama and then Clinton, or Clinton and Obama, there was a temporary ban on Iraqi refugees. And that was an important ban for the security of the country. Interesting thing is today, when we have another ban for the security of the country, then there's this big outrage. It's interesting. The double standard of the left continues to this day. I'm perplexed how this can continue to go on and on and on. But it does, and it's so very, very, very sad. Well, what I want to do is I'm waiting now for a guest. Her name is Shirin Moazin, and she's going to be my guest. We're going to talk about some issues about Iranian political prisoners. And she was supposed to call in a couple of minutes ago, and it's been a little bit delayed there. And so we will wait for her patiently because she's a scheduled guest today. But I thought I would take some time with you right now. I want to spend some time talking about these issues. And just bear with me a little bit here as I get things secure. I want to talk to you about several issues today that are important on the agenda. And I'm going to go to my mailbox and call up a couple of issues. And I want to talk to you about the things that are happening in Iran that are important for you to know about, because I keep tabs of everything that goes on there. And waiting for my computer to load right, sometimes it is a pain. But just remember, there's a lot of things I want to talk about today. And one of them has to do with Iranian political prisoners. They're always on my heart, all the time. Just waiting here. Here we go. Now, you know, I have taken some time to share with you the happenings of Iranian political prisoners, in particular, Arash Sadashi, who went on a hunger strike. I've been talking about him. They failed to give him adequate medical care, and he is still lingering in his desperate condition after he ended the hunger strike. At the time that he'd had the hunger strike, his wife had been in prison. The reason he'd done the hunger strike was so that she would be released. Well, she was released. Oh, here is my good friend, and she is here right now on Blog Talk, just a little bit late. I want to welcome to you, to the Cross in the Desert, my good friend Shirin Moazin Zeta. Shirin is the president of Borajerdi Civil Rights Group. While in Iran, she was involved in computer software engineering, and she worked 10 years as a teacher in college and other institutes. She was born in Iran in 1977 and immigrated here to the United States 4 years ago. I want to welcome you, Shirin, to the Cross in the Desert. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Well, Shirin, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you. I'm fine.
Well, Shirin, you are president of the Borajerdi Civil Rights Group, and I want you to kind of explain to our listeners a little bit about the group that you're president of and what the group does here.
At first, I want to say hello to everyone. I'm so happy to be in your radio, and thank you for listening to me. Actually, I came to United States 4 years ago, and I, along with my friends, established a Bourgeois de Civil Rights group in 2013 to conduct a variety of activities for advocating, protecting, and supporting the basic civil rights of religion freedom, freedom of conscience, and the rights of women globally.
That's very good. Shirin, I find it really great that you came here to the United States and you founded this group for civil rights, for human rights, for women all over the world, and that through this group you have activities. You are active in protests. And I like that you are always thinking of your Iranian friends that are in prison in Iran, denied human rights, and that I always see you talking about their human rights. And I think it's wonderful that you came here to become an American citizen, but you haven't forgotten the special people of Iran that are suffering so much. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it is, because I was one of them. I was one of them that spent 1 week in prison under torture. So I never forget. I never forget what happened to me and what's happening to my friend and my people in Iran.
You understand what it's like to not have human rights, to be in prison. You understand what it means to suffer, and that's good that you come here and then you don't forget them. Now, a lot of times, Shirin, I will see your group protesting outside of the United Nations when President Rouhani has come here, that you have protested the activities of President Rouhani. And I wanted to talk to you just a minute about your protest. I always talk about Iran on here and always point out that that President Rouhani has not been a moderate president, that under Rouhani there has been much more problems with human rights. There's been thousands of executions that have happened since President Rouhani has been president. And you keep people informed about that, and you stand out and protest. How successful are your protests when you go and protest? Do you get a lot of people to listen to you?
Actually, no. Because... No, that's why. That's because there is a biggest regime lobbyist in the United States. You know, we try to. We never forgive. We never. I'm sorry. We never give up, and we try and try. But the regime lobbyists are so powerful in the United States, and they work against us. They spend money to. And shot us and to finish and destroy our job, but we do our job.
So there is a group in Washington, and they're called NIAC.
I have to tell you some story about what happened in United States in our region. Because we work here as a human rights activist, and we see something that maybe other people cannot see and cannot face it. Actually, a few years ago, and during some years ago, many people from Iranian regime came to United States, and they are dependent to regime. They have money, and Iranian regime support them. Actually, I can say it's unusual, because ordinary people cannot come in the United States so easily. They cannot give visa to enter in United States so easily. For example, a mother cannot get visa to see to visit the children, her children. But for an event in Manhattan for Ashura, for example, is a religious day for Shia Muslims. You can see thousands of regime lobbyists and that spread Khamenei's picture. How did they come to United States? Street rules long onto America only applies to ordinary people, and tourists are free to come. Over the past year, we have witnessed the arrival of thousands of Iranian dictatorship regime of lobbyists. They came to America, investment, and make up their own base. When you see someone come to America as a refugee, and after a while, he began to advertise the Islamic Republic of Iran, it is doubtful, you know, and I hope that governor, United States governor, creates smarter system that ordinary people are less damaged, and they can get the right and actually the right considered and identify the real terrorists. I think right now we have the biggest lobbyist of regime of Iran. Actually, it is a dictatorship regime, and I hope that can see one day that there is no terrorist in the United States.
Well, that's really unfortunate, and maybe with this temporary ban that it will stop the flow of these particular people, the lobbyist group that are causing so many problems for Iranians like yourself who want to peacefully protest. Shirin, what is the goal of this government lobbyist group from Iran? What are they trying to do here in the United States?
Actually, they are everywhere. You know, we face them when we try to talk about our people, talk about what's happening in Iran, but Iranian government do to people. They torture them. They they rape them and they jail them. When I try to find someone to listen to us, we found out, oh my God, there is a lobbyist that they try to change our whatever we do, whatever we say, and. Actually, this is obvious. They try to make their base here to have power because United States is the first country in the world, and government can United States government can change, can affect the other country, can force to the Iranian regime to free people, to don't capture them and. They can ask for freedom for Iranian people, so they can.
So
if they make them powerful in the United States, they can change everything for themselves.
So they are here to disrupt your activities. They're here to tell a different story, and they're trying to convince other people that there's nothing really bad happening in Iran, that there's real freedom there. So they disrupt your rallies, and they're here to influence our government to do everything they can to support Iran and to help Iran when really we need to pour more sanctions on Iran. So I see what they do, and they're very disruptive. And as I mentioned before, perhaps this temporary ban will stop this flood of people for a while coming here to cause so many problems. Do you believe that?
Yeah, and also, don't forget, Iranian regime are the biggest dictatorship regime. So they create terrorists around the world. If they have they founded something in the United States, they are making their base here. And don't forget, this is the terrorist base.
You're right.
So I think
now,
it is
Shirin,
the most important. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I wanted to just switch our topic here and get to the main reason why you're here today. I want you to talk about Mr. Borajerdi. He is a person that you have spoken out for a very long time. He is a political prisoner, and I think that a lot of us human rights activists know a little bit about him. But what I want you to do now is to take some time and share with us who he is and why he was imprisoned in Iran. Tell us about Mr. Bourjerdi.
Yes, thank you for this opportunity. Actually, let me to tell you short story about my country and what happened for Mr. Bourjerdi. When I was 2 years old, a disaster happened in our country. I mean, the Islamic Revolution. My land was an Islamic country. More than 90% of our people were Muslim. We had the biggest Christian, Jewish, and Zoroastrian community between the other Middle East country. But we were living in peace with each other before the revolution. Our land was under development. Honestly, we had some issue, same as other undeveloped countries, but we were in the right direction of progress. But after establishment of Islamic State, everything became worse. Poverty, discrimination between the people, especially against women, non-Muslim communities, and political and ideological distance, censorship, and lack of freedom of speech, conscience, and press. So no one could find a correct way to escape from this evil regime. The cruel governor were doing all crimes and saying that it's by the Lord's order. It's a God order. In this religious state, if anyone objects or protests, they will accuse him to a big crime, waging war against God, and they can easily kill him based on the Sharia laws. Many people believe this suffering comes as God wills, so they lost their hope and their trust on God. Among these bad years, I can say that dark years, a kind man invited people to pray just for God. He was advocating this time promoting separation of religion from state as well as freedom and human rights. About 1999, a few years after beginning of his movement, I heard about him. Mr. Hossein Kazemini Bourjerdi was known as Ayatollah Bourjerdi. He was a secular mind, religious leader. It was a unique and special opportunity for me to find an Ayatollah who was teaching people something that I found a few years later in the UN Charter of Human Rights and the Constitution of modern countries. Actually, he could change extremist religious men to moderate and open mind one, and it was amazing. I think imagine Iran and how difficult was that day. How people couldn't think about other things, and he could change them. He also had this ability to change the people who were denying our religion and faith because of the behavior of the ruling clerics to God believers. Most of those people was assisting in the social welfare as volunteer, and the ceremony were mostly in sport halls instead of mosques and religious places, and most of Mr. Bourjerdi's speeches was about the Lord and how we can pray him regardless of pure religious or political view. However, this movement was in opposite of the governmental religion and the ruling theocracy. They were trying to promote a cleric-made version of Islam and monotheism. So that people should follow the Iranian supreme leader as a representative of God on the earth. They call the founder of the regime Khomeini and his successor Khamenei as the grand of chief of Muslims and the successor of the Prophet Muhammad. So they didn't tolerate anyone to present a new interpretation with different viewpoint on monotheism. So they arrested and jailed Mr. Brujadi a few times and tortured him in the medieval prison of Iran due to promoting monotheism, excluding politics. They also confiscated his office and his mosque where he had begun his religious activities and banned him to continue his activities as, and called him a domestic media never to speak about Mr. Brujadi and his movement. In addition, they killed his father, who was well-known grand religious scientist in Iran and author of more than 40 books, and confiscated his mosque as well. Despite of these and these pressures, Mr. Brujadi never gave up, and he found other ways to follow his activities, such as establishment of a network between followers and holding a ceremony in their house, publishing paper, books, and voice recording to promote his idea between the people. Therefore, the population of his followers.
I was just
going to
say, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to summarize a little bit of what you're saying. Mr. Brujadi believed in separation of religion from state. He believed the problem in Iran was this theocracy, this blending of religion and politics was causing all of the oppression, the human rights violation. He said, look, this has to stop. Let's separate the two, which is what we have here in America. We have a clause about separation of church and religion and state. And he had a viewpoint that was different than the supreme leader, and because he had a different viewpoint and he gained followers to believe his message, they didn't like that. They believed that Mr. Brujadi was rebelling against God, and that's why they put him in prison, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And so go ahead. And you said while he's in prison, he had publications and he had messages. He could still teach what he was teaching to people outside of the prison. Go ahead.
Yeah. And the last gathering, I think the biggest independent gathering of monotheist followers in June 2006, at the biggest domestic sport hall in Tehran, where more than 100,000 people participated. This was a serious alarm for the government, since the ceremony showed that the people were following the independent religious, excluding political interface, and without any support by media and advertisement. So the religious dictatorship nature of Iranian rule, they attacked his house and arrested Mr. Brujadi along with his family members and thousands of his followers on October 2006. Mr. Brujadi has been jailed and tortured in the prison because of insisting on his peaceful movement in the Iranian society. He has been deprived of access to a free lawyer as well as appropriate medical treatment and furlough. During the long years of jail, he never gave up. So from inside the prison, he continued his campaign against religious dictatorship by writing letters to world authorities and media, as well as religious and human rights activities, to inform them about the cruel government of Iran and their crimes, and calling them to assist Iranian nation.
Now, I wanted to ask you, he has recently been released for medical leave. I wanted to know, since this has happened, what condition is he in, and will they put him back in prison?
Actually, after about 11 years in prison, his sentence was 10 years, but they didn't arrested him. They didn't release him. And after 11 years, and they got $300 million pledge, and they banned her in his home. And they put some condition for him to never talk to other people. Other people shouldn't come to visit you. You never should talk to any media, and many, many other conditions. They didn't say what they turn him back to prison, but he's monitoring all the time. And actually, he's in prison right now at home.
So a lot of these political prisoners, like Mousavi, the head of the Green Movement, has been under house arrest since the 2009 presidential election. And Mr. Borjordi is under house arrest, too. He can't talk to anyone. He can't go anywhere. He's being monitored. And what you're describing, Shirin, is what happens in Iran if you speak out against the government, if you disagree on their religious viewpoints, if you have another opinion. In Iran, this is how you're treated. You have no human rights. You have no religious freedom. You have no rights.
Exactly. And I mentioned this before. If you say something against the government, you called as a someone who say something against the God.
Mm-hmm.
They can kill you if you say something bad to government, if you say something about that they do. You know, they can kill you because you are because they have an Islamic government. They have we have in Iran Islamic government.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to know, what is the future what is the future going to be like for Mr. Borjordi? What will happen next? Do you know?
Let me tell you about him, because I think it's important to your radio listener to know. Mr. Borjordi sent a lot of letter from inside of prison to all religious leaders and political leaders, and avert them for extreme Islamic and terrorists that comes to the world. And for some reason, some of them ignore them. I can say many of them ignore him. And what he said, what he told them to them about terrorists and dictatorship. He tried to talk about the danger of extreme Islam or radicalism in Islam. And because he knows very well what are doing and what they want to do for an entire the world, not just in Iran. One of the, I can say, one of the base is in Middle East, and they try to separate our bases around the world. Look at the Europe, what's happening over there. Look at the United States. We have to be aware, and we need to listen to someone like Mr. Kazemini Borjordi. He tried to help people. He tried to keep the real belief to God, regardless of religion, regardless of, we have all kind of religions, they are respectful. But he say he tried to keep our faith correctly to God, not abuse of our faith, you know.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. So Mr. Borjordi is a voice to the world from his imprisonment, and he's warning the world of what radical Islam can do to their country. He's trying to be a voice of hope, and he's trying to warn and educate people about radical Islam. Is that not right?
Exactly, yeah.
This is very important, Shirin. I wanted to ask you, because you have explained to us in detail about Mr. Borjordi and what he did and why he was arrested and that he's under house arrest. I have a question for you with radical Islam and what's happening in the world. You know our president has put a ban temporarily on those countries that sponsor radical Islam. One of those countries is your country, where you used to live, Iran. And many Iranians are upset about this ban. But you have shared with us today why it's so important to make our country safe, because of look what radical Islam did to your country. Tell our listeners what you feel about this ban on immigration. How do you feel about this?
Actually, it's too early to judge. I want to tell all of my people, Iranian or other people who are worried about this ban. I'm talking to them, and that it's too early to judge. I told you, as someone who lived here and worked here, I see some issue in this country, that there are many terrorists. They live here in the United States. So they are dangerous, and we have to think wiser, and we have to be aware of them. You know, during Mr. Obama's presidency, the Islamic State and the Islamic parties and group have been promoted in Middle East and North Africa. On the other hand, the people who were struggling for freedom and democracy, like Mr. Kazemani Bujardi in Iran, have not been supported. Okay? So we understand that the authorities of each country should be the first plan for their people. But we never forget that we cannot isolate ourselves in part of the world, since our distances are bound together. If we're concerned about the security of the U.S., we should demolish terrorism and its origins, such as the Islamic State of Iran.
Yes, good. I think you understand that we are all about safety here. And I think that you know firsthand what it's like in Iran to be oppressed, to have no freedom. And I think you would agree that, as you've pointed out, the ban is only temporary. And we are a country of refugees, but we have to do something to protect our country. We have to improve our system. So I want to just say thank you so much, Shirin, for sharing about your group, to share with our listeners about Mr. Borjordi. And our thoughts and our prayers are with him. He is a very strong, tough man who never gives up, and we should, as Americans, support Mr. Borjordi, to pray for him, to petition for him, because he wants peace and freedom, and that's what you want, right?
Right. Thank you. Thank you for you, for many help that you do to Iranian people.
Now, Shirin, one last question. Where may people get in touch with your website and learn about what you do here in the United States as an Iranian American? Can you tell us how they can get in touch with you through your website?
Sure. We have a website with URL bcrgroup.us. They can reach our website, and they can contact with us with the email and actually phone number, and they can read about news. They can read news and some article about civil rights and human rights, women rights, and we like to have some help from all people who are interested in human rights and civil rights.
Well, I tell you what I'd like for you to do when we're finished here with our interview. I want you to go ahead and post your website on my Facebook page so that all of my listeners can gain access to it. Can you do that for me?
Sure, of course I can. Yeah, I do.
Well, again, thank you, Shirin, for the hard work that you do for supporting human rights and women's rights and supporting Mr. Borujordi. And thank you so much for being a guest today on my program, The Cross in the Desert. It's been a delight.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Randy.
Okay, God bless you. I want to thank Shirin Moazen Zeta, president of the Borujordi Civil Rights Group. Isn't she an amazing person? And I said this in the beginning of our interview, and it's worth repeating again. I know some Iranians that live here, and they assimilate to our culture. They go on living. They enjoy their freedom, and that's great. But most of them don't spend the time speaking out for their Iranian friends in Iran. I have Iranian friends that have come here, and they have organizations. They have book signings for books they've written. They speak out for the human rights of Iranians that are still oppressed in Iran. And I think it's so special with someone like Shirin, who has not forgotten her people, even after she has moved here, become a citizen, enjoyed our freedoms. She has remembered her family, her friends, her people in Iran. I think that is something that is so very, very special. And that's why I'm so happy to have someone like her on the program. As we were having the interview, I had a message from my good friend Kaveh Tahiri. He's a human rights, Iranian human rights advocate living in Turkey. And he has written, I haven't gotten it yet, a detailed report of Arash Sadeghi. And he apparently, Arash, is back on his hunger strike since his wife has been rearrested. I wanted to talk to you about that tonight. Iranian human rights defender and writer Golrak Ebrahami Ari, who was sentenced to 6 years in prison for writing a story about the cruel practice of stoning, was rearrested this past Sunday and put back in prison. And she was returned to Evin prison after being picked up by the Revolutionary Guard officials while on her way to visit her gravely ill husband, which is human rights defender Arash Sadeghi. She had been out of prison on a temporary leave since the 3rd of January, awaiting a judicial review by Iran's Supreme Court about her six-year imprisonment for writing this unpublished story, believe it or not. But this review is now being deliberately held in the courts by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And because of her rearrest, apparently, and this is something still kind of new, her husband, Arash, who had ended his hunger strike about a month ago, has went back on his hunger strike. Well, if you follow my program, you know the poor physical condition he's been in because of the hunger strike. It has caused real serious damage to his kidneys, his vital organs, and he's been lingering between life and death. But since his wife has been rearrested, he has decided he has to go back on the hunger strike. His original intent was to have this hunger strike to get the government to release his wife. They did do it, but now they've rearrested her. And it's just, these are peaceful activities. Golrak and Arash are peacefully protesting the oppression of Iran. But of course, as you listen to Shirin, you can't do that. You can't do that in Iran without the consequences of imprisonment, torture, and then sometimes death. And so the authorities have effectively taken Arash Sadeghi's health hostage. They continue to deny him access to medical care he desperately needs. And now his wife, and what I'm asking you to do, as my listeners, is please remember him in your prayers, and please speak out. We have spent an awful lot of time doing that, and we're going to never give up. We're going to let the Iranian government know that this is unacceptable, that this is inhumane, that it's against every standard of human rights in the world, and we're going to stay on this issue until he and his wife are released. We're not going to give up because, in the end, that's just who we are as human rights defenders. We never, ever give up. Well, I want to take the last few minutes today, and I want to talk to you from the Bible. I want to give you hope. Just like Mr. Borujordi, just like Arash Sadeghi and his wife Golrak, their backs are up against the wall, and it seems hopeless. It seems like there is no way out of this situation. And yet I find, when I read God's word, I find the hope and the comfort to continue fighting. And I want to talk to you today about a situation where the Israelites had their backs up against the wall. God had just miraculously, through Moses, put plagues upon the Pharaoh of Egypt, so much so that the Pharaoh, in the end, let the Hebrews go. He knew he was no match for the miracles of Yahweh. And so the children of Israel have been wandering through the desert, but the Egyptians have said, we are not going to let them go and worship. We're going to get them. We're going to get them. We're going to find them. We're going to destroy them. And so here are the children of Israel with their backs against the wall, and I want to read to you from the Bible. Exodus chapter 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi Haroth, between Megiddo and the sea, in front of Beth Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. God is literally putting the Israelites right up against the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so. God had a purpose in their dark trial. He deliberately positioned them in a place of no escape except the Red Sea. And the reason God did it, and it says it right here, he wanted to show the Egyptians he is the true God. He wanted to receive glory. This is very interesting. When sometimes we are put in difficult situations with no hope, behind the scenes, because we don't see the big picture, behind the scenes, God is working out a plan for our good and for his glory. Let me read on. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of the Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people, and they said, what is this we have done that we have to let Israel go from serving us? So, and listen carefully, he made his chariot and took his army with him and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them in camp by the sea by Phihaurot in front of Baal Zephon. When the Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. And they feared greatly, and the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, it is because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to bring us in out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been far better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die here in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and all you have to do is be silent. Isn't that our complaint, just like the children of Israel? God, don't you love us? Don't you care for us? You put us in this situation, there's no hope. Why, we would be better off what we were doing before. We knew you. What are you trying to do to us, God? And God says to us, be still. Know I'm God. Fear not. Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. You see, God was going to demonstrate through his people. Again and again, he did it through miracles while they were in captivity, and the Pharaoh let them go. But he's saying again to them, he's saying, I will show you. I am who I say that I am, and I am your true God, and I will do something today. You will see my salvation. Don't be afraid. Stand firm. This is what God is saying to you and me. As we face dark trials, stand firm. Fear not. Let me read on. The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen." Then the angel of the Lord who was going before the host of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness. And it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots and horsemen. And in the morning, in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into panic, clogging their chariots' wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen of all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. What an incredible story. I mean, anyone that has seen the movie The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston remembers how Cecil DeMille at that time created this incredible scene of the Red Sea being parted, the children of Israel walking across, and then the Red Sea coming back down over the chariots and drowning them. All of us, I'm sure, have seen that incredible, memorable scene. But I want you to get the zest of what's going on here. God says to you today, be afraid, stand firm, and you will see the salvation of the Lord. Now, it might not be a huge dramatic display like walking across the Red Sea and the parting of the Red Sea. It may not be something that dramatic. But what God says to you today is that I know your situation. I understand your trial. And I have created this trial so I can demonstrate my goodness and my power towards you. I have let you into this situation. I have allowed this to happen to you because what I want to do is show you my great love and compassion, and I want to demonstrate my power and my glory. I want you to see that this situation, this dark trial you are going through, that I have control of this situation. I have the power to change it. But I want you to learn something through this trial. I want you to know something. This trial is for your good. It is for your benefit. And in this trial, you're going to grow. Your faith is going to grow leaps and bounds. You're going to see my power demonstrated in this dark valley, this trial. And when you come out of this trial, when you walk across that Red Sea on dry land, you're going to see your enemies. You're going to see those afflictions against you be drowned, be destroyed, be removed. No wonder the Bible says in James chapter 1, count it all joy when you fall into diverse trials, because it's for the strengthening of your faith. Humanly speaking, when we face trials, it's everything, anything, but it's hardship, it's pain. But the Bible says, count it joy, because through this trial, not only are you going to grow in a closer relationship to God, but your faith is going to be strengthened. And none of us wants to go through that. I don't. You don't. But God says he works everything together for our good, for those that love him and are called according to his purpose. What I see in this incredible story that I love the best is the picture of God like a lion fighting for us and destroying our enemies. If you've seen the movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis, who wrote The Chronicles of Narnia, you'll never forget that beautiful lion called Aslan. And Aslan, of course, represents Jesus. And you see Aslan defending his people, going to war to protect his people throughout this movie. And this is the picture we have here in Exodus chapter 14 of God fighting for his people, standing in the gap for his people, never leaving or forsaking his people. He led them to this place so they had nowhere else to go, so he could demonstrate his power and glory for them. You see, sometimes when we find these hardships and these trials, we don't see the whole picture. But God does. He sees the end from the beginning. And the one thing we see in Exodus 14 is that God is involved in this situation. He's never leaving them. He's never forsaking them. He is fighting for them. He is with them. And God's message to you today is, if your back is up against the wall, like the children of Israel, and you see no hope, you see no escape, the best thing you can do is embrace your trial and trust in the Lord that he is going to deliver you. He is going to purify you. He is going to sustain you. And in the end, he is going to destroy that affliction against you. He will destroy those enemies who are trying to destroy you. He will defend you like a lion. I think that's why C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Chronicles of Narnia, had as its central character Aslan, the lion. Because that's a picture of our God. A picture of our God. He can be as tame, if you will, as a lion in some ways, and yet be vicious as a warrior to defend us. And so as you hear this story today, my question to you is, what is your concept of God? Do you see your God as the children of Israel saw their God? A warrior defending and protecting them? Or is your concept of God someone that is not so interested, not so involved, but angry at you because you don't measure up to his standard? I hope that your concept, if that's your concept, will change today. That you will see God as this lion, this warrior, standing in the gap for you, defending you, leading you through difficulties and trials with his hands of grace and compassion. That's the God that I serve. The God that will not let the enemies triumph over them. The Bible's very clear about who God is. And on my program, I do my very best to show you that this God is a God of absolute mercy, compassion, and unconditional love. And so today, we've learned about Mr. Bergiordi. His back is up against the wall. This regime will never let him go. They will do everything they can to silence his opposing viewpoint and his vision for an Iran that is not captivated by religion, but that it's peaceful and secular, with people can make choices and are not forced to believe a certain way. That's his vision for a free Iran. His back is up against the wall. Arash Sadeghi and Golrakh are in prison with their backs up against the wall. I'm praying today, and I hope you will join me in praying for Mr. Bergiordi and Arash and Golrakh. God will deliver them in their trial and circumstance and will bring freedom and salvation to them. You see, that's the God that I serve. He is a lion. He will defend us to the very end. And he will bring deliverance. He will bring salvation, because that's who he is. He is a God that is an ever-present help, the Bible says, in your trial. Psalm 46, God is our refuge. God is our strength, an ever-present help in the time of need. I want to thank everyone today in the chat room. I want to thank Patricia and every one of you that has participated today. I want to remind you, on my Facebook page is the website for Shirin Moazin's Bergiordi Civil Rights Group. Please contact her. She has lots of important information about Iran and human rights. It's been a privilege today to be with you on the Cross in the Desert. I'm going to see you right away again on Thursday. Have yourselves a good week. God bless you. See you once again on Thursday for another edition of the Cross in the Desert. Have a great week.
Woo!